Welcome to the PreparedX Podcast, your complete source for crisis, emergency, business continuity, and security preparedness interviews, news, and much more. Now, your host, he creates chaos for a living, Rob Burton.
Hello and welcome to episode 38. Oh, it's been 38 episodes already of the PreparedX podcast. In this podcast, I interview Mark Hoffman, who is the founder of Anesis Consulting Group, and he is out of Ontario, Canada. Mark is an active member of the crisisconferences.com. Or within crisisconferences.com, where he writes and comments on various crisis, emergency, and business continuity related topics. This was a really interesting interview with Mark. We got talking about a lot of things as it relates to corporations and how they manage and prepare for various different types of disasters. We covered a lot in this conversation, from scenario planning, a tremendous amount on exercises, which is, you know, as our listeners, you will know, PreparedX is all about exercises. He spoke about Fort McMurray and the fire and how it caught out the whole of the city. Lots of lessons from that. And he touched on the workforce and how the workforce should work from home. And he had some real detailed advice on, you know, making sure that the workforce is prepared for emergencies and from working from home if there's an emergency. So again, great information. I think you're really going to appreciate this interview. Here's episode 38 and my interview with Mark Hoffman. Good morning, Mark. How are you doing today?
Excellent, Rob. Thanks.
Mark, just before we get going, for our listeners, could you introduce yourself and just talk for a few moments about your career and how you got to where you are today?
Sure. It's kind of funny. You know, I always thought I was going to be like a director or vice president of IT or something along those lines. So I just started out trying to get as many different IT jobs as I could. I started as a computer operator, and I kind of got into coding, and I found out I really wasn't very good at that.
Right.
And I became a DBA and then started to work as a project manager. My goal was really to touch every aspect of IT that I could so that I could run a shop someday somewhere.
Right.
Then I got the opportunity to get into IT consulting, which was good because I got to see a lot of different industries and a lot of different business models. And it was during my consulting career that two kind of key things happened, two lights kind of popped on for me. First, I realized that I love being a consultant. I love the opportunity to get out and being involved in a lot of different initiatives. But the big thing for me was I had the opportunity to get involved in some disaster recovery projects because of a few major disk failures, and later, believe it or not, of all things, because of Y2K.
Right.
And I realized that that's where I wanted to be, that something clicked and it occurred to me that this was what I was built to do. So from there, I became more and more immersed in the business continuity and crisis management world, and I just really have never looked back. I've had the opportunity to consult with IBM and influence quite a few clients, and it was good to see how a company of that magnitude does business. And because of that experience, I was able to find out what I liked and didn't like about their business model, and then tailor my own approach and business model around what I learned from them. And so as I work independently now, that's what I've been able to do for the last several years. I put on my LinkedIn profile the quote that says, if you find a job that you enjoy doing, you'll never work a day in your life. And what I said was that quote's attributed to Mark Twain, but it could have my picture next to it. So I just absolutely love this. This is what I do, and this is what I love to do.
Well, that's great. And, your passion certainly comes through, based on my personal interactions with you. So, again, appreciate you taking the time to come in and be interviewed today for this podcast.
I appreciate it.
Yeah. So as it relates to then emergency preparedness and businesses, you know, from your experience within the market, what are some of the biggest mistakes that organizations make in their efforts to prepare for a disaster?
Well, you've hit on something that's kind of important to me here, Rob. So what I'm going to do is kind of focus on exercising, and it's failure to exercise or exercising poorly. If I can steal a line from the military, I'd say the more you sweat in training, the less you bleed in battle. And
right.
Yet somehow companies simply ignore the fact that they need to exercise their plans. And I've been given some thought to, you know, why this is. And I think some companies don't like to show that they're vulnerable. Exercises can demonstrate a lack of preparedness, but wouldn't you rather find out during an exercise than during an actual disaster of some kind? You know, some don't exercise because they don't have a plan, which is even a bigger problem. I actually had a client object to the fact that I gave them a red status after a disaster recovery gap analysis. They went red status because they had one application with a DR solution and dozens without. And they objected because they said, well, they were recoverable. I mean, after all, they did backups. So they didn't exercise because they literally couldn't exercise, you know.
Right.
But for others, I've seen that it's their fear of failing an exercise and the political impact that, you know, would come out of that. I've had a client reject exercise scenarios because the topic was, quote, too sensitive.
Yep.
For them, I wanted to run a cybersecurity scenario where their main business system was compromised, which is a real possibility.
Yep.
But they rejected that because they said it was too politically sensitive. And they were afraid that if they didn't do well in the exercise, that their board of directors would think they weren't prepared, which, by the way, would have probably been right, but they would have learned from the exercise and they would have been able to close their gaps and then report progress back, you know, to their board.
Sure.
So instead, what they did was they chose a less political scenario. They didn't establish specific objectives and they claimed to do well, in air quotes, because of how they felt about the exercise, rather than measuring against a predefined set of objectives.
And right.
That kind of leads to the second issue with exercises is that, you know, it's not just a binary on off, yes or no, do we exercise or not kind of thing. It's businesses can exercise, but they fail to exercise well.
Right. Right.
So when I conduct an exercise, I like to build an exercise plan that identifies specific objectives and what the success criteria is and so forth. And then we exercise and measure against those specific objectives. So it's clear what we're trying to accomplish and what the measurement of success is. And when we're done, we write an exercise report that documents the results against the objectives.
Right.
That way the exercise is planned, it's clearly understood, and it's not a subjective rating of success. It's kind of like calling your pool shot, you know, knowing what you're going to try to accomplish rather than just busting up a bunch of balls and hoping something falls in and then claiming success if it does. Another thing that companies will do is they'll test using techniques that wouldn't be used during an actual disaster. And this is a problem because they've changed their protocols. They're testing using, you know, in an invalid practice. So it's important to run the exercise as close as possible to the real incident. Some other things, I've seen businesses just go through motions. They'll over-simulate what steps they would take.
Right.
Oh, we'll just recover this server.
Yeah.
You know, you can't yada, yada, yada through we'll recover the server. You have to, you know, demonstrate that you can do it.
Right.
And so what happens is people don't understand their role or they don't understand what the actual procedures are. I actually had a number of business leaders call me in a panic one time when I scheduled an exercise, because even though we had been through multiple tabletop exercises with them, when it came down to actually calling out a full-on crisis management exercise, they realized that, yeah, they really didn't know what to do. And so I'm glad they admitted that, because then we were finally able to, you know, close some gaps and really conduct a meaningful exercise.
Yeah, you know, we find the same in terms of those lessons, and we call those lessons to be learned, because quite often you'll get through the exercise, you'll put the report together, you know, they'll agree upon those findings and the recommendations. But more often than not, you know, those changes will either get made or they won't get made. But more often than not, the most important part is, do they get revalidated? Do those changes actually work? And so if we do go in for the second exercise or a follow-on functional exercise, more advanced exercise, going back to your objectives, you know, we need to introduce, you know, those gaps that were in from the first findings. Have they actually worked? Have they been implemented, be it a procedure, be it a capability? And we need to validate those again. So that's certainly something that we see as well.
That's the first thing I do when I do a follow-up. You know, maybe a year-over-year exercises. We'll look at the recommendations from the previous year and see if they've addressed them or not.
Right.
And if they haven't, then you have to start to wonder how seriously they're taking it.
Sure. In terms of scenarios, what are some of the, you know, you touched on some exercises there and briefly touched on, you know, a couple of scenarios as you were talking through that. But in your experience as a professional in the trade, what are some of the scenarios that concern you the most?
Well, it's an interesting question because I really don't believe that we should write our crisis management or business continuity plans from a scenario perspective. But that said, it does make complete sense to realize that some scenarios pose higher threats to some organizations, and to ignore those threats would just be negligent. So my answer, I guess, is going to be sort of client-specific, mainly due to their locations. So, for example, I have a client with an office in London. We have 98 people there, and I worry about them. As you know, we hear seemingly month after month of various terrorist activities in London. Now, we have procedures in place to reach out to them. If we hear of an incident, we want to make sure that everyone is accounted for. But for them, I worry about the people. And that same client, by the way, has offices in New York, Boston, and Toronto. So, you know, terrorism is a real concern, and you know, and its impact and its potential disruption on the business, but really more importantly, the impact on the people. I have another client in the Caribbean. It's, you know, it's tough work, but somebody's got to do it. We keep a close watch for hurricanes for them. And for them, it really, in addition to worrying about the people there, I worry about their customers and the company's, you know, my client's reputation if they aren't able to recover from the storm. But I think probably the biggest thing right now, though, for all of the above and everyone out there is cybersecurity and privacy. Mm-hmm. Now, people wonder if cybersecurity belongs in the crisis management program, and I argue that it absolutely does. Now, I'm not suggesting that, you know, you and I, Rob, you know, and other crisis management professionals need to necessarily have that high-tech cybersecurity skill set, but those cyber techies do need to be brought to the table during a crisis, just like we would bring in a technology recovery team,
sure.
You know, if we lost a data center. So it's also important to realize that not every cyber incident is a crisis. So we need to develop pre-crisis response protocols for the cyber team and understand what triggers a crisis and when to call in crisis management. I like to use an approach of identify, triage, and respond, where once we detect a problem, the tech team triages the incident to determine its scope and its impact, and then as part of that, they make a determination whether they need to engage the crisis management team or not.
Yep.
So if so, we get engaged, we call the right people to the table, we execute our protocols, which include things like, you know, managing the response and determining our communication requirements and so forth. And then the other side of that coin would be privacy. And I've done a lot of work to integrate privacy breach response plans into the overall crisis management protocol, keeping in mind that not all privacy breaches are cybersecurity related, right?
Right.
So there could be human error and things like that. So for privacy, we focus on identifying the issue, you know, determining its scope and impact, and we lay out a strategy for notification of the affected parties and so forth, basically trying to stop the harm as quickly as possible and manage the message that's going forward.
Sure.
communication during a crisis is always a key priority.
Yeah, you know, as it relates to cyber, what we see in certain industries, I would say probably financial services being the big one. With regards to the incident management team working on, you know, quote unquote, issues that could turn into a wide scale crisis for the organization, we see those teams working in silos and struggling to get out of the mentality of bringing the wider corporate crisis management team together as early as possible. Even, you know, we advocate just bring that team together so they can at least prepare. If this is going to be bad, if this is going to be real bad, we need to get our ducks in order. And so what we try to do is try to get that incident management team to at least make the wider corporate team aware that something is ongoing, because there's nothing worse than you waiting, as we know, and we hear this all the time, right? It's 6 months, it's 300 days, whatever the average, you hear different people talking about different averages of numbers in terms of how long this data was being lost from inside the organization. And, you know, we knew about it for 6 months, but we didn't say anything. So, it's about awareness across, and it's about trust of those other members of those other teams that work and help in supporting, cyber team. And so do you see something similar?
I do, and it's not just cyber. It can be. I've come across companies where they're not managing the whole, all of the aspects of crisis management as a program, and they might have disaster recovery off in their own silo, or even business continuity off in their own silo, and then the crisis management team. I'm not even sure what their role is at that point, because right. There's no cohesiveness across the organization. I've seen where privacy is sort of left on its own. And to your point, also around, bringing it up, making people aware of it. I saw an incident where it wasn't a cyber event. It was just a human error. Emails were sent publicly that shouldn't have been sent. And I think it contained account or billing information. And they just tried to cover it up because nobody wanted to get in trouble for it. And, man, that only makes it worse. There's just so much downstream impact to a scenario like that, again, to your point, we have to bring sort of a level of trust to the table and make sure that it's better to speak up than to just try to cover up.
Yeah. And going back to the exercises, that builds that trust within those different teams that come together. And every tabletop that we run, every functional exercise that we run, more often than not, individuals that are on that team that are coming together, we'll see a certain amount of them shake hands and they're meeting each other for the first time, or they're new members on the team and they're meeting, the existing members for the first time. So it's really interesting. Those organizations that check the box, that come together just once a year, you're not going to have that trust if you're just coming together once a year, if you're not bringing the team together at least quarterly to talk about these challenges. So great conversation with regards to this. Moving on, Mark, as it relates to natural disasters in recent years, is there anything that you've seen in terms of what's caught the public and emergency services off guard? Has there been some, specific event that you've noticed, and why was it challenging?
There have been some significant events, and what it calls out to me is, and I think I'll start with why I think people are getting caught off guard, is that I think that there is a trend among crisis management professionals and maybe some of the executives, where we tend to back away from worst case scenario planning. People always talk about 9/11 and Hurricane Katrina or Hurricane Sandy and so forth, and they think that these are kind of once in a lifetime events that can be overlooked because planners think that the probability of such an event is extremely low, and it is. But the impact of that event is so high that it can't be ignored, right? So a lot of times we tend to back away from using these worst case scenarios as examples because it feeds into that, it'll never happen to us mentality. And So we kind of focus on smaller scale incidents to sort of, you know, build up the likelihood of it and to get engagement and to get ownership and participation.
Right.
But we're essentially doing a disservice to our business if we don't prepare for the worst. So a couple of things. For example, the fire in Fort McMurray, Alberta last year turned out to be a worst case scenario in many respects. They had unbelievably high winds and the fire coupled with record dry conditions. And so it was a rapidly changing environment and it pushed the emergency responders, you know, to their breaking point. And it showed them gaps that they hadn't even considered. And, you know, that's what a worst case scenario will do. It will stretch your reality beyond your imagination.
Right.
And so it'll show you things that you never even considered. So, for example, in that Fort McMurray case, you know, they were prepared to communicate within their own community, within their own fire department and within their own team. But they didn't realize that they had a gap in how they would communicate with outside units who were also responding to the fire. So this affected their sort of concerted effort and their common response. It affected evacuation planning and their overall execution. And the other thing that made that a worst case scenario was it's a one road in, one road out city. So the evacuation was slow. It was a real nightmare for them. And there were things that they hadn't even considered because their imagination hadn't been stretched.
Right.
And that's where some of those lessons learned and lessons to be learned, you know, can help. And they've definitely found several action items, things around the use of social media and better communication and evacuation planning and things like that.
Right.
But I'd also like to call out something else, and this is important. Hurricane Ivan. It was a Category 5 storm. It had 165 mile an hour winds. It ripped through the Caribbean, Jamaica, Grand Cayman, Cuba, and then the southern U.S. back in 2004. In some Caribbean countries, power was out for months. I mean, it's hard to imagine that, but, you know, power was out for months. In Grand Cayman, fewer than half of the island's hotels were usable after 5 months. So you think about the impact of a storm like that on an island whose main industry is tourism.
Right.
So as you can imagine, Hurricane Ivan sort of became the worst case scenario that ended up being the standard against which all of our planning is measured. But the problem is it happened 13 years ago. So, you know, a number of people who work there now either weren't there then or they only remember it from their personal experience, not from their professional experience.
Right.
And then along with that, and we see this in fire drills too, we do the preparation year after year, the planning year after year. We exercise it time after time after time. And what you get is preparation fatigue and complacency. It hasn't happened in a long time. We know we're prepared for it. We do it by rote. And the next thing you know, you have a complacent workforce.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's the enemy of our preparedness. And sometimes, unfortunately, you know, it takes a wake-up call before we get truly ready again.
Yeah, I was just, it's interesting. You mentioned the Caribbean and storms. I was just on the phone this morning, actually, with a gentleman from BP, and he's down in Trinidad and Tobago, and he mentioned the tropical storm that just came through, and again, you know, it was only a tropical storm, right, which is still, you know, can cause a significant amount of damage and challenges for them, and you know, he was mentioning some of the, you know, issues around that and power and various other things that, you know, didn't work out well. Again, always trying to learn from those different challenges. So, it's, you know, I guess it is the season for hurricanes anyway. So we're expecting, you know, apparently, you know, some fairly significant storms. So we'll see how that pans out. And as it relates to that, then, I mean, it could be a power outage. It could be some other issue of not getting access to, you know, your office location. But as an organization that needs to keep its operations moving, certainly those critical components of the operation to make sure that we can obviously keep, you know, our customers in service or keep our products being produced or whatever it may be in terms of our services and products that we offer. What can organizations do in terms of its employees and working from home when they can't get access to those locations?
Well, working from home is becoming a common strategy, isn't it? I mean, companies are looking to cut down costs. They're not necessarily looking to, you know, enter into long-term agreements for end-user space and things like that. So, you know, working from home is becoming a very common approach. But I always cringe when I hear people say things like, oh, we'll just work from home.
Right.
First of all, we don't just do anything during a crisis. You know, we respond by following our protocols, which hopefully we've thought through and exercised and so forth. So kind of with that as the background, let me address several things that I think we can do to help prepare our people to, quote, just work from home. The first thing is we need to identify the total scope of that workforce and who requires access. And then look at the various options for providing secure access to networks. So it's things like, are you going to allow your employees to use their home computers with something like a token or something that you know, ensures their security? There are risks associated with that. You don't know what people are using those computers for. You don't know if there's viruses there and so forth. Or alternatively, will you force them to use company laptops if they're going to connect in? You need to think about your VPN capacity. How many people in total could be trying to connect? It's interesting. We use the term dial in, although nobody dials into anything anymore. But you know, how many people will be trying to dial in at time of crisis, and do we have the capacity for that? I'll come back to the laptops in a minute because that's another potential sticky point. But, you know, beyond keystrokes, we need to think about their day-to-day activities. It's not just dialing in and connecting to a network. We have things like conversations with key people, dependencies on other departments. Do we have our phone lists? What about incoming calls into the facility? You know, how will they get rerouted? What about customer-facing activities? Can all of these things be done from home? Is that really feasible? Think that through. And that leads me to the next thing, which is testing it. You know, send your people home. Have them do specific business functions remotely and make sure that it works. Again, I'd rather find out during a simple Tuesday morning test than find out that something doesn't work in the midst of a crisis. Had a client say that they would have people work from home to run a critical job that needed to be run through their system. But when they tested it, they found out that their people didn't have adequate bandwidth at home to run the job effectively. So they had to kind of scramble and try to figure out what else they would do. I think it's also fair for companies to set some standards of what it's going to be like to work from home. I mean, let's be honest, not everybody is suited to working from home. Their home environment may not be conducive to customer-facing activities. Not everyone has the discipline to work from home. So I think businesses need to realize that there's a high likelihood of a drop in efficiency and productivity during this period. But I think it's reasonable to let employees know that you expect them to have sort of, even if it's temporary, just a dedicated space without background noise, without kids screaming, without the TV on, you know, to sort of set the standard of what that work environment should look like.
Right.
I think it's important to make it safe. Don't allow use of remote access from unprotected locations like coffee shops and things like that. And make it safe for the employees, too. You know, don't have them use their personal mobile or home phone numbers to call customers, and, you know, unless they can block the number and things like that.
Sure.
But the big risk here, I think, is, and just one last point, Rob, is that, you know, enforce the behavior. So if you rely on company laptops, then make sure your people take the laptops home. I had a client who claimed that 99% of their workforce of about 1,500 or so could work from home during an incident that affected their building. The problem is less than half of those people actually took their laptops home.
Right, yeah.
Right? So if you have 800, 900 people who are supposed to be working from home and an incident occurred overnight and those people don't have their laptops, I mean, think about the mess. You're not going to suddenly source 800
right.
laptops and distribute them to people all over the place. You have a major impact there. So your strategy has to be in line with what your day-to-day practice is. I guess the other way around, your practice has to support the strategy.
Right. Yeah, we had a client who, you know, based on the results from a business continuity tabletop exercise, and actually we ran a drill as part of the exercise, a fire drill initially, and they introduced a grab bag process. So they acquired some grab bags for laptops to be pushed into. Now, you know, in some scenarios, if you're in the building and there is a fire, and you literally your priority is your life, right? And there are other you know, potential issues. You know, you've got an active shooter in the building and you need to get out, or, you know, there are a few things, but, you know, under normal circumstances, if you sat at your desk to grab your laptop is, you know, shouldn't be too much of an issue. And like you mentioned, overnight, you know, taking the laptop home in case something happens to the building overnight. So I thought it's quite interesting that, you know, they procured, it wasn't a big office space. I think it was like 60 of them. And those that were critical to the operation were the ones that were to prioritize taking their laptops home. So, you know, very interesting and good advice that you provided there. Appreciate that.
We just had this conversation yesterday. We had a fire drill training, fire warden training. And, you know, their advice was walk down the stairs empty-handed. And I raised my hand. I said, hold on. We have a business continuity strategy that says people are going to work from home. Are you telling me that people should not take their laptops home? And they backed off of it. They said, no, it's fine. Bring right. your laptops if it's safe to do so.
Exactly, yeah.
And it was interesting. I said, well, would you rather have people carry their laptops like a notebook under their arm or put it in their bag? And their recommendation was to put it in the bag because they can put the bag over their shoulder and it keeps their hands free. So I thought that was interesting. I hadn't really thought that through.
Yeah. You know, another interesting one with the fire drill as well is to block a stairwell. And, you know, and then they have to come back up and go across a different floor or, you know, try and get out a different way, you know. So that always, you know, throws a spanner in the works, so to speak. And, you know, we had someone on this particular stairs, about the, you know, they were on the fifth floor, fifth and sixth, I think, and we were down on the third or fourth. And, you know, when they got to that point, we said, no, you can see smoke coming up the stairs and you can't get down any further. And I guess they could only cross over every second floor, so they had to go back up two floors and what have you. So it's always good to throw in, you know, kind of those, you know, those little wrenches, so to speak, to get people to think on their feet, because they're going to be, are going to have to think on their feet if these things start to unfold.
That's right. And that goes back to exercising and exercising well and having a culture that will allow you to challenge people like that rather than making it so easy for them that we know it's going to be a success. That's very important.
Yeah. You know, how important is it, in your opinion, to have good relationships with your local first responders?
To ignore that relationship ignores a key part of your response team. So this training that I was in yesterday for the fire wardens, you know, the instructor went through the list of the responsibility for the fire wardens, which is, you know, doing a quick sweep of the floor to make sure that they can locate everyone, make sure people know it's time to evacuate, helping to usher them down the stairs into the emergency evacuation area and assembly area and things like that. But their instructions were really clear. You are not the fire department. You are not paramedics. You are not here to rescue people, right? First responders are coming. They'll be on scene. They're trained. They have the equipment and the protective gear to do that function. So it's important to recognize, you know, the vital role that they play. And you also want to rely on their expertise when it comes to emergency planning, because they can find flaws in your plans and make recommendations based on their day-to-day experience, right? I mean, this is, you know, this is what they do day in and day out, and they're going to see things a little differently.
Right.
You want that relationship too, because obviously in an emergency, you want to be timely and effective and on point. So ideally, if you can engage them in exercises and walkthroughs, that's helpful, because the more they know about your facility, the more they know about your company and your hazards and, you know, what you might have in and around your facility, the better it'll be at time of crisis. A big thing is communications. You know, how many times have you seen, you know, police or fire or somebody hold either a brief press conference or make a brief statement to the media? If you have a relationship in place with the first responders, you will have already discussed crisis communications with them. So you can participate in that press conference, or at the very least have a relationship with them, so that you'll be given a heads up that one is being held. And then that way it'll give you time to coordinate your message and help you control the message and how it's communicated. I can't emphasize how important that is. It's just like also kind of in the whole thing of communications is knowing who to contact.
Right.
You don't want to be exchanging business cards, you know, in the smoke that's coming out of the building. It's important to know who your contacts are ahead of time, how to reach them, and have them know who you are so that it's not a cold call.
Right.
So building that relationship with communications officers and so forth is key. And it's going to lead to just overall higher cooperation. They're going to understand you. You're going to know what they're going to do. They're going to know you're not going to be in their way, right? And so you've practiced it, you've rehearsed it, and just by nature, you'll get a higher level of cooperation.
Yeah, that's certainly a big part of especially those organizations with facilities that have hazardous materials on them. You know, a number of our clients in the chemical, oil, and gas field, that, you know, they build those relationships ahead of time. They bring the fire department in. It may be a walkthrough initially, but then they build up, and eventually those that are more advanced will exercise with the responding partners. And that builds that trust, like you mentioned. So when I bring my responding first responders onto site, and you tell me you've got a certain quantity of a certain hazardous material in one location on the site, I trust what you're saying versus me turning up for the first time, because this is, you know, we've not had that, you know, relationship developed ahead of time. You telling me a certain quantities in that tank, I have to know for sure. So I again, it's not handing that business card over like you mentioned, but it's actually trusting you because we've been here before and we've built that relationship over a period of time.
Yep, exactly.
And just to wrap up, this has been a great conversation. As we start to wrap up here, Mark, you've spoken a fair bit about about exercises over the last, you know, 20, 30 minutes here during the interview. But the final question I have for you is about tabletop exercises. And in your experience, what are the three major benefits of conducting simulation exercises?
The first thing it does is it identifies gaps in your readiness. And let's not make a mistake here. That's a good thing. I always tell people that every incident, even those that aren't designated as full-on disasters, are learning opportunities. So we always ask, were we prepared for this? How would we have handled this? Did we, you know, do we address this type of problem in our response? And exercising a scenario gives you that in-depth assessment of your plan and in your team and your documentation and processes. And, you know, if the culture is right, it's good. It's okay to say, man, we suck at this, or
right, yeah.
Stop, I don't have this documented properly. That's okay. And that's why I like to use the term exercise rather than test. I mean, you know, we're testing in a way, but we're exercising our response and making improvements as we go. It you know, makes your team more familiar with the process and their responsibilities. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, this is really important, is it builds ownership.
Yeah.
An exercise transfers the ownership of the plan from the author of the plan to the participants. So as they start to see their role and understand it, they start to have input, generally very, very good input, as to how they can accomplish certain steps or certain tasks, or they might add tasks that previously weren't thought of. and you know how they can effectively achieve various things. So then the plan goes to a new level, and the ownership shifts to those who are using the plan. And it's not only the plan itself, but it's the overall program that benefits from that, because now you have an engaged business partner who can help you with things like, you know, governance and future growth and other future initiatives. So that's there's some downstream benefits to that too. And the other thing is, and I'll close on this, is that it teaches the team to work with each other. It eliminates what I like to call the Alexander Haig syndrome. You remember back when President Reagan was shot, Alexander Haig, who was then Secretary of State, he made a statement at a press conference after he had just laid out the chain of command. You know, it's the president, the vice president, the Secretary of State. And he said that he was, quote, in control here at the White House, which is great, except it's not consistent with the Constitution and what he just laid out as the chain of command. So the last thing that you want at time of crisis is an unfamiliar executive coming into an otherwise well-organized team and going all Al Haig on everybody. And you don't want things like posturing and jostling for position, right, and arguing over priorities. And, you know, these things are enemies of a controlled response. And so exercises build, you know, that team and establishes how they'll work together in a crisis. And that's really important.
Well, this has been an excellent episode. I want to, again, thank you for your time, comments today, Mark. Just before we wrap up, though, do you have any final comments for our listeners? And if they do want to get a hold of you, how would they contact you?
So first, Rob, thanks for this podcast series. I've listened to it. I found it to be really informative. And also want to give a shout out to the ICMC, the International Crisis Management Conference website that you've started. I mean, it's just so helpful to be able to have, a sort of a peer relationship and ask questions and share information. Yep. and so forth. So, really, really happy with that. As far as people reaching me, I'm on Twitter at @mhoffman_CBCP. That's a little bit of a mouthful. I'm also online at my website is enesis.ca, or by email at mhoffman@enesis.ca. Or probably the easiest way to find me is just to have people come to the ICMC website and they can find me there, where I'll just put in a little plug. I'm currently doing a blog series on business impact analysis best practices, which is, I like to think, pretty interesting.
Yeah. No, excellent excellent information. And again, this will be well received by our listeners and beyond. So again, thanks for your time today, and I hope you have a great rest of your day, and we'll be in touch again soon.
Sounds good, Rob. Thank you.
Thanks, Mark. Take care. That's it for episode 38 of the PreparedX podcast. I'd like you to do me a favor. Please go to iTunes or the other podcast outlets, wherever you found us. Please rate us. Please rate us, because that's really important for us. Again, on iTunes or elsewhere, I'd really appreciate that. Thanks again for listening today. Until next time, be safe.